The following talk was given by Steve Hagen in Minneapolis on June 23, 1997. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Welcome to the second class on Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. My teacher used to talk about the antique dealer and how he would train his apprentice. They would just set the apprentice, the student, in a room with a masterpiece. And the antique dealer wouldn't say anything about it. He would just set the student down with this masterpiece. And the next day, same thing. Put him in a room, put in another masterpiece. And they would just do this every day for about 2 years or so, never saying anything else, just leaving the student in a room with a masterpiece, you know. And then finally, after a couple of years or so of this, when he felt the student was ready, he'd put the student in a room and bring in a fake. And right away, the student would recognize the fake. So this is how Zen teaching takes place. And it's something very subtle. The antique dealer is never pointing out anything, never saying, "Oh, look how wonderful this is," you know. But just show it. Just show it again and again. But if you build it up, what you're building up is just some kind of fantasy. You know, some kind of imaginary world. And this is what Suzuki Roshi meant at the beginning about keeping your mind pure. This is how we make our mind very impure. We're always doing this. It seems like we have to emphasize something or stress something or make something very important. Otherwise, we think that it's not worth pursuing, it's not worth looking at or thinking about or engaging in. It's kind of like the mentality that we have, say, about the Super Bowl, you know? Either you win the Super Bowl, and you come in number two, who cares? Nobody forget about you, you know, you're no good. So we have this kind of mentality, like, you know, everything has to be wonderful, the best, the greatest. But we tend to do this in our mind. What is the best? What is the greatest in any given thing? You can't really say. So the point of Zen, then, is just simply to engage. Learn to engage in each moment as it is. And here you'll find all the wonderment that you need. We had ended last time on page 27, right at the top. He's talking about kill the Buddha. And I think I just want to pick it up there briefly and finish this section. We had talked about to kill the Buddha. If you recall, that means when you encounter a Buddha on the road, kill him. Because that Buddha, that's just something you're imagining. Once again, this is something you've built up in your mind. You've created some wonderful thing here. In the next line, he said, if the Buddha exists somewhere else. Well, to exist somewhere else, we call this foreign in Zen. If something exists somewhere else, it's foreign. It's not here. It's not domestic. It's not, because the reality is always right here. It's immediate. It's not over there. So if it's over there, if the Buddha exists somewhere else, in other words, if in this case now Buddha just simply means reality or Dharma, truth, reality as it is not somewhere else. If you meet the Buddha on the road, if it's something else out there, something else that you see or encounter, that isn't the immediate experience that you're living in from moment to moment. The Buddha cannot be somewhere else. Buddha, in this particular instance, we're not talking about the historical figure, Gautama. We're talking about reality itself. That is how Buddha is being used in this way. It's another term for Dharma, which means reality. So we're not necessarily talking about a human being or something of that sort. We're just talking about here and now reality. This does not exist somewhere else. So if something exists somewhere else, well, what is this? The things that exist somewhere else are just your thought, you know, your ideas. Things that you imagine to be separate and apart from you. But the experience that you have is always immediate and direct. This is our actual experience that we have from moment to moment. So reality is never apart from you. If you see something apart from yourself that you have to get, that you have to build up, that you have to diminish in some way, this is always just your imagination. Just mean thinking. In Zen training, we're always on the alert for this sort of thing, our imaginary reality. Okay, a little further down, he says, we do not exist for the sake of something else. And that was a point I wanted to make too. No, we don't exist for the sake of something. Reality is always right here, right now. You don't exist for the sake of something else. This practice doesn't exist for the sake of something else. It's just simply that all things are just like this. It's immediate and direct. Nothing exists for the sake of something else. And then he mentions rules here. He says, the purpose of rules is not to make everyone the same, but to allow each to express his own self most freely. So once again, here that rules, if we have rules in practice, now I haven't been able to show you much in the way of rules in practice. We had a little bit of meditation instruction last week, a few rules there, or also just in the meditation we just had now, we sit in a particular way, move in a particular way, get up in a particular way, and leave in a particular way. Following rules, the way I get up and move and walk out, I'm kind of following rules in a sense. But these are not rules for the sake of something else. The point is to just be aware of what you are doing. So in the case of meditation, in the case of Zazen, we assign you a few simple things to do. You get up in a particular way, you turn in a particular way, and you step out in a particular way. You're aware of which foot you're using, etc. Not that anything about this is holy or sacred, or if you violate it in some way, the heavens will fall in, or somebody ought to, you know, hit you with a stick or something like this. The point is to be aware of what you're doing in each moment. So these rules are not for something else. The rules are just simply there for this moment right now. What are you doing? Pay attention. So that's the meaning of rule here. And these rules are quite different. These are kind of rules of action. These are not moralistic rules. For those of you who have come through the precept classes with me, we discussed this, that in Zen and in Buddhism, we don't have moralistic rules. The precepts are not rules. They're not regulations. The precepts are to examine our experience, the actual experience that we have prior to our encapsulating, putting into some kind of conceptual form. This is precept. So moralistically in Zen, we don't have any rules or regulations for that. There's no idea of sin or something of this sort. The human problem is not sin. The human problem is ignorance. We're not paying attention. And so that's morality. That's the basis for morality in Zen and in Buddhism. In this particular case, we talk about rules. They're not moralistic rules. They're rules of behavior, rules to help you learn to pay attention to what you're doing from moment to moment. Yeah, I saw a hand back there. Was that you, Phil?
I'm having trouble with the idea of purposeless purpose. In regards to this intent, or when I come here, I came here because it was interesting and it kind of grabbed me. Mm-hmm. And the whole idea behind this, I think, is to become awake or aware, whatever that means, I don't know. But the rules that you're saying really aren't rules are there, obviously, because they, over time, have shown that they can aid and abet the person becoming more aware or more awake, I'm assuming. So there has to be some purpose attached to this, but it's subtle purpose, or
the whole purpose of this practice and this way of life is to wake up.
So that's, there is a purpose behind rules and the effort.
Well, wait a minute. Which rules are you talking about? The rules of behavior that I just mentioned? Yeah. Exactly. So that's what I was saying. Like, for unfortunately, here with the kind of classes that we have, I can't lay out too many of these things. If, say, we form a group and we get our own place and we actually have a meditation schedule, I'll lay down a few very basic, simple rules to follow. There's very few. There shouldn't be too many. They're very simple, and they have a purpose. And the purpose is just simply to help you become aware of what you are doing from moment to moment. If it doesn't matter how you enter a room, you just enter a room any which way you feel like, and then you kick off your shoes, you don't know where they went, but you know, now you go in and your whole purpose is just to get in there before the bell. Very sloppy mind. You know, if you want to awaken in this moment, you need a few guidelines here. So we give them to you, just enough so that you can focus your mind and settle down. The problem enters in when people think that somehow these rules are more than what they are? That somehow they're moralistic rules, that they're, well, you didn't do this the right way, or whatever, you know, as if somehow you've sinned now, you know. We make these kinds of mistakes very easily, very quickly. And Zen, this is absolutely deadly if we don't understand what this is about. The simple thing is, and what I tell students when we have this kind of a setup, you come into a room, if you can't remember how to come into the room or how to sit down or whatever, that doesn't matter. Because the rule doesn't matter. What matters is that you know what you're doing. So if you can't remember how to enter the room, just enter the room with full awareness. Just pay attention. What foot are you using to step into the room with? You know, and you walk to the place you're going to sit and then just sit down, but sit down with full awareness. You're aware of the fact that your mind is somewhat agitated because you're not really sure what you're supposed to be doing. Just simply be aware of the fact that your mind is agitated, you know, or the fact that you don't know what you're doing. But of course, if you start paying attention to what you are doing in that moment, the fact that you have this I don't know mind, what's the problem? You're fully awake in that moment and you're handling it, you're dealing with it. That is the purpose of Zen. So it's very simple. At that point, we can get rid of the rule, even the rule of behavior, the rule of action, not just the rule of the moralistic rule. So do you understand my point? Yeah. But he said these rules, the purpose of rules is not to make everyone the same, but to allow each to express his own self most freely. And this is another point that we don't understand. We might think that freedom is, well, I want to come in and express myself any way I want, you know, and we think this is a freedom. But we don't understand that nature and life itself is kind of constraining you and putting limitations on you. You know, if you look at, like in the arts, in poetry or in music, I think of, like in the old classic days in classical music, Mozart. He composed music in a very rigid form. The classic form is very rigid, very tight. And yet within this very tight, rigid form, he was able to express wonderful freedom and beauty. Bruno Walter said of Mozart, when somebody asked him, well, what is Mozart? And he said, Mozart is the sky. Freedom. Completely open. Ever changing. Never the same. You know, just constant shifts and change in light and beauty. But always the sky. Always this complete freedom. This was Mozart. Another case, I remember listening to an architect one time talking about his life and his profession, and he was always working within constraints, he said. You know, you have the lay of the land, you're going to build design a building for a particular piece of land, and you're confined by the form of the land. You're confined by the client's ability to pay. They have a certain budget, they can only... So you had monetary constraints, you know, and all these different kinds of constraints that come and impinge on his freedom, his expression as an artist, you know, as a creator, this architect to create this wonderful building that had to function in a particular way. And that was another constraint. It had to function in a particular way. He had to design something that would serve the purpose that his client wanted, you see. But he said that this was always kind of difficult. The tighter the constraints would become, the more difficult the job. But he said at the same time he noticed that when it got tighter like that, and he'd have to spend more time with more ingenuity working this through, but when he did, he came closer to producing a masterpiece. So this is really true, that this is where we can fully express ourselves within some kind of form. And the same thing is true in Zen, to confine yourself to a particular kind of form. If you really are serious about this job of awakening and seeing your true self in this moment, you will not find it if we just say, okay, anything goes here. Then pretty soon we just have a real mess here. There's no discipline, there's no focusing of mind, and no time at all. Time goes on and we haven't learned anything. So this is very important in Zen. But at the same time, as I said before, this is not a moralistic kind of rule or regulation. It isn't like you're bad or sinful if you don't learn the rule or you don't stick with it or whatever.
Just thinking that this is a wonderful, for me, explanation why tradition is good.
Yeah, tradition is good up to a point. But see, there's always the balance. If we're not paying attention to what we're doing, you know, pretty soon the tradition becomes encumbered with all kinds of things. Even in Zen, we have all these traditions, you know. Yeah, there's all kinds of extra stuff. When I was in Japan studying, you know, I learned about all kinds of things that really I'm not about to show you. They're not really necessary, you know. Yeah, well, like, for example, you know, I learned to hold this whisk, you know, this big thing with a horse tail on it, you know. You know, and you learn to flash it in certain ways, you know, for certain kinds of ceremonies and things. They taught me this, you know. I'm not going to pull out a whisk. And no matter what we do in the future, I don't know if I'll ever pick up another whisk, you know. But you can imagine, I don't know for sure the history of this, but I can imagine somewhere back in, say, ancient China, early days of Zen, that was probably a kind of an implement that they had to keep flies away. You know, you just kind of, you know. And perhaps there was one particular master that everybody really loved and whatever, and he was always working this whisk, you know. So somehow it just kind of got into the ceremony, and pretty soon you have ceremonial ways of flicking it. You know, there were particular movements you'd make, you know. And these get transmitted and whatever, you know. So that's tradition. You got to watch out. You know, it's like a fellow was telling about a woman that he was dating at one time, and she had him over one time to. She was baking some squash, you know, and she had taken squash, the kind of egg shaped, you know, narrow end and a wide end, and she cut it in half and then put one this way on the pan and took the other one and put it that way, you see. And then she slid it into the oven, you know. But he was running in, it was in kind of a ceremonial way. She just very definite, and yet there was plenty of room in this pan, you know. So he asked, well, why did you do it that way, you know? And she said, well, it's because my mother did it, you know. He knew her mother, so at some point when he was over there, he said, well, why did you do it that way? And she said, well, my mother did it that way, you know. And then he says, is your mother still alive? She says, yeah. And he says, well, why don't you ask her next time you see her? And so she did. And it turned out the grandmother now. She said, well, it's because my pan is only so big, and the only way I can fit it into the pan was to turn them this way, you see. Grandma had a reason, you see. And so she did it. But then the daughter didn't quite understand the reason, but she just saw, well, you do it this way and this way, and now the granddaughter's doing it, has no idea why you do it, you know. So this is tradition. We have to be careful. Thich Nhat Hanh, one of the things that I liked about his group and how they do things is I forget now, it's in his bylaws, which I've got, I should look at those, but every 2 or 3 years, I think it is, they would get together as a group and they would examine everything that they're doing to see if it's really necessary anymore. When we no longer live in a culture where there's a lot of flies and we don't work these whisks anymore, maybe we don't really need this, you see. So this is something we should be paying attention to. If we really understand the practice of Zen is always just to come back into this moment and to realize what it is that you're doing. And I mentioned architecture a while ago. One of the basic laws in architecture is form follows function. You do something because it serves a function. And then within this, if you follow this simple rule in architecture, now within this you can produce wonderful pieces. So this is something we shouldn't lose sight of. It applies to everything. Just understand what's behind something and now carry it out and do it. If in what we're doing around here, don't let me show you something. Don't let it go too long. If you don't understand why we're doing something, then raise your hand and ask. And if we can't come up with anything, then maybe we should forget about it. Okay. Well, at the bottom of the page, he said, when we have our body and mind in order, everything else will exist in the right place and in the right way. This is really true. You might not agree with that at first, but you should look at this very carefully. If you're in kind of an ordinary dualistic kind of mind where you want to control and manipulate or whatever, get a kind of a grip on your life, you might not agree with this so much. But this is really true, that when your body and mind are in order, then everything else will exist in the right place and in the right way. But instead of working on ourselves, getting ourselves in order and sane, in touch with reality, we start working on the world out there. So he said that usually without being aware of it, we try to change something other than ourselves. We try to order things outside us. He said, but it's impossible to organize things if you yourself are not in order. So this is something. First of all, it's much easier to just look at yourself and to see, because if there's some conflict here, here's you, you're here, no, there's something else out here, and there's something about this arrangement that's bothering you or disturbing you in some way. It's very difficult now for you to go out there and to change that other thing, particularly if it's another person. But what you can do is take a look at yourself. So this is the step that we take. Dogen calls it a backward step. This is a step we take in Zen. And this is where you can do all the work right here. And if you get yourself in order, you'll notice that the whole world gets into order. And it's really true. If you learn to do this, basically you can kind of just accept things the way they are. Now, it doesn't mean that you can't change things or influence things or whatever. You certainly can. But if you're not in order, what are you going to do? You're just going to go in there and just keep disturbing the world, which is what we ordinarily do. And so we look at the human world and it's very, very disturbed as we find it today. So the most important thing is before you try to fix that thing out there, take a look at what you're doing yourself. Then he said on the next page, he said, you are the boss. And he said, when the boss is sleeping, everyone is sleeping. When the boss is doing something right, everyone will do everything right and at the right time. And he said, this is the secret of Buddhism. So this is the secret of Buddhism, is to look at yourself, to purify your own mind. And then with that purified mind, then maybe you can help someone else out there. Any questions about that? That was actually last week's talk. I got to get going on this one. Yeah.
So is leadership pretty wasteful thing then?
Leadership?
Yeah.
No, leadership depends on the leader, you see. You can't say leadership is a wasteful thing. You look in nature, you know, you go up to Isle Royale in the wintertime. I saw a film on this where the moose would be trekking through the woods in the heavy snow, you know, and there'd be a leader would be up front, and then all the other moose would follow along behind in the track of the leader. But before long, the leader would get tired, so the leader would just step aside, and the group would file past, and after they filed past, that leader would get behind and kind of rest. Now it could follow in the trail of the others, you see. And so it was just kind of a way of conserving energy. So it depends on the leader. But if you have a leader, you know, a person who can truly lead can also get behind at times. Nobody can lead in every aspect of things. Like, for example, in organizing this, you know, somebody, I think you know, we're trying to organize a group here. And there's no one person here who can lead everything. If I were to have the position as a head teacher, for example, well, I know nothing about finances and business. I mean, it would be foolish for me to take on a role like that. I know nothing about that sort of thing, you see. But at the same time, there are different individuals here and there who do have expertise here and there, and they can lead, they can help out, they can pitch in. But at any given moment, you might have to step behind. Step behind others in this particular area, you know, someone else. What I'm saying is that, you know, the ship needs a rudder. Somebody has to steer, you know, and direct it, etc. But no one person can do everything. But to say that leadership then is unnecessary, no. We can't have this. Nature itself, this is what I was trying to point out with the moose example, nature itself will organize things in particular ways and set up little kinds of groups and functions and things, and then different kinds of systems and dynamics and people and whatever will fill the different kinds of niches and things. For example, I know that they've done studies of ants, you know, where they notice that if you take a population of ants, they notice that 20% of them are very industrious, you know, and do all the work, you know, or most of the work, you know. Then there's about 20% that are really lazy, don't do anything, you know. And then the other 60% in the middle, sort of in between ants, you know, they do some stuff, but they're not, you know. Well, they've taken each of these groups, and they'll take the industrious ants and they divide them off from the in-between ants, you know, and then they take the lazy ants and they put them over here, you know. And pretty soon, among the lazy ants, 20% of them become industrious, you know. 60% are kind of so-so, and the 20% remain lazy, you know. Same thing with the industrious ants. You get them all to themselves, pretty soon 20% become lazy, right away. 60% become kind of in between. So leadership or whatever, yeah, these are natural functions that rise out of just the normal natural functions of life. And for each one of us, we should be wise as to just see how these different kinds of things come up. They'll come up for a moment and fall back down, or different kinds of dynamics are taking place, both spatially, temporally, different kinds of things are happening. And as Zen students, our job is simply to pay attention to this, to notice what is taking place. An emphatic statement like, well, leadership is bad, or this is, you know, Zen would never make such a statement. That is an extreme statement. We've gone to some extreme with this. We avoid these kinds of statements because we just simply don't find it. So everything that happens, you can't deny it. Here it is. It just happens. But the question is, the point is, in Zen is, now, how are you going to deal with this? How are you going to interact with this? Are you going to step in there with your desire to kind of shape things and control things and push things around and make sure everything goes according to your desires? Well, that's pain, suffering, confusion. It's conflict with others, etc. Or are you going to learn to see the actual situation, you know, that you're in and then take it from there? And that's kind of the Zen way. Any other? Yeah.
I've been wanting to ask this since the beginning of the last question. It sort of seems funny, and I sort of make a joke out of it, but I also mean it. It seems so tiring to be aware all the time. Why just not be aware? Like, I always have to be aware. I don't want to be aware all the time. You know,
yeah.
There's a fight there.
Mm-hmm. Well, then don't. just if you get tired of being aware, just go to sleep. You'll wake up again, you know. Another thing in Zen, if you're pushing too hard or something's becoming too taxing, too stressful, too frightening, too whatever, take a look at that. You're getting off the mark or somewhere. You can bet that you're working out of a greedy mind, a grasping mind. You're trying to force an issue or whatever. So just notice that and back off. And even in the area of awareness, you know, it shouldn't make you that tired. And if it's making you tired, well, then I would say, slow down. Rest. As my teacher used to say, rest your frontal lobe. Or he'd say frontal robe. But I knew what he meant. So don't work too hard on that one. Well, I wanted to get into the marrow of Zen. I'll just read a little bit at the beginning here. In the Samyuttagama Sutra, it is said that there are four kinds of horses: excellent ones, good ones, poor ones, and bad ones. The best horse will run slow and fast, right and left, at the driver's will, before it sees the shadow of the whip. The second best will run as well as the first one does, just before the whip reaches its skin. The third one will run when it feels the pain on its body. The fourth one will run after the pain penetrates to the marrow of its bones. You can imagine how difficult it is for the fourth one to learn how to run. Well, this image, it comes from a story of Bodhidharma, the first Zen patriarch in China. He had four students, and of these four students, he said of the first one that he has penetrated my skin. The second student, he said, penetrated my flesh. third student has penetrated my bones, fourth student has penetrated my marrow. So there's kind of different levels of students, you know, in terms of the understanding of their teacher, Bodhidharma. So we have this idea of these four horses or these four students. But here Suzuki says, when we hear this story, almost all of us want to be the best horse. He said, if it's possible to be the best one, we want to. If it's impossible to be the best one, okay, then we want to be the second best. You know, so this is our normally our kind of thinking. You know, of course we want to be the best. But on the other page, at the top of the other page, he said that sometimes the best horse may be the worst horse, and the worst horse can be the best one. So while we always think it's the first that's best, you know, it might be the worst that's best. And whatever I think of that, the worst is best, it reminds me of up in Duluth, there's a there's a meat kind of a family meat packing place where they make bratwurst and all these kind of stuff. And one day I went by there and they had a sign out front that said that our worst is best, you know. So and I always think of that when I look at this. But the worst is best. That might be so. Because how can you say what is worst and what is best? As he said just a little further down, he said, if you practice Zen in the right way, it doesn't matter whether you are the best horse or the worst one. Why? If you practice Zen in the right way, it doesn't matter whether you're the best student or the worst. Why would that be so? What is he saying? Yeah, Niles.
Well, best and worst are themselves only ideas.
Yeah, what is best? What is worst? And best needs worst. And worst needs best. How do you define best and worst, etc.? You know? Worst is always going on within a realm of totality, needing everything else around to prove that it's the worst, you know? But at the same time, so it's the worst, it needs to be whipped to the marrow before it starts to learn, before it starts to do something, that you know, maybe you have to go through life and get a few knocks, you know, have some difficulties, and then you become a Zen student. Maybe this time of being the worst Zen student possible occurred before you showed up, before you met the teacher. And so now you're all primed and ready to go. You're ready to learn this stuff. And so you appear like the best student. But why are you the best student? Well, it's because you were probably the worst. And if you're the best student, as he said here, you come in, he said, those who can sit perfectly, physically, usually take more time to obtain the true way of Zen, the actual feeling of Zen, the marrow of Zen. Why so? Well, because if this is easy to you, if you can sit down here and get into a full lotus position very easily, well, maybe you don't have to work too hard. You don't have to really grapple with this and struggle with this. Of course, it isn't a matter of just getting into a full lotus or something of that sort. The point is to learn to pay attention to what you're doing from moment to moment. The point is to learn to observe your mind. And if you've already have lived a life of pain and suffering and confusion, maybe your worst horse days are behind you, you know? And maybe you come in as the best horse and you can sit so well. Maybe you have to go through some pain yet. Of course, the pain will simply be that if you don't learn, you can come and do this Zen stuff for many years, and if you don't learn anything, that'll be kind of painful for you. And then maybe you can begin to ask, you know, why not? Why haven't I learned anything? And the point is, what this is all about is to learn to observe your mind from moment to moment and see what is going on. Learn how it is that you tell yourself a story, that you explain things to yourself all the time, meaning that it's out there, it's removed. The Buddha is something apart from you. It doesn't exist right here. And that's how you're spending your time in your life. So even though you can sit very well and you do this for a long period of time, you keep looking for something else out there. You're not really paying attention to what's going on right here, right now. So even though you're a very good student, you haven't learned anything. So that's how the best can be the worst, and worst can be the best. This is the point I wanted, when I asked you before, why can't you say what's worst or best? The point I wanted to raise at that moment is that because in the territory of reality itself, in other words, Dharma, reality as it is prior to our putting a lot of labels on it and values on this and that and the next thing, before we start to do that in the realm of totality, we don't find any worst or best. This worst or best kind of stuff goes on in the realm of delusion. After we have divided the world, we've set off one thing against the other, now we decide, oh, this is good, this is better, this is what I want to do, and look at this, I'm pretty good at it too, aren't I? You know, and then now we identify with that, and now we think we're pretty good, you know. Maybe not. In terms of reality, in terms of awakening, in terms of enlightenment, yeah, that's not particularly good, you know. You're just running away with delusion. You come back and you enter into this realm of delusion, and then you think, wow, you don't have any claim on being a great student or whatever, but you realize that you're suffering, now you attend to it very well. At that time, you're going to begin to heal up all of these kind of divisions. This that we call awakening. This is enlightenment. And there's your bad student. No, but the bad student awakens. Yeah.
But how would you not classify something like the Oklahoma City bombing as bad? And that's where I kind of get lost in this. I mean, that to me, no matter how you look at it, is a bad situation. Mm-hmm. I don't understand that. I mean, what could be good of that? Or not good, because that doesn't make sense. But
no.
I guess, how is that not bad?
Well, it is bad. In the realm of delusion, where we have different kinds of things, and that's where we live. We live in this muddy water of delusion. This is the human life, is everything's very murky, and we have a hard time sorting everything out. But clearly, something like that seems to be bad. Yeah. Now, what are you going to do about this bad? You're going to take this guy who did this, and then we kill him. But isn't killing bad? Isn't that what we're talking about? Killing bad? What are we doing? You know, how are we going to treat this issue? How are we going to bring people to their senses? How are we going to make people see what's going on? And what exactly is wrong here? Why is the Oklahoma thing, why do we call it bad? Well, it's because this whole issue has come out of human delusion. And what is human delusion? Human delusion is just simply to divide the world, to set one thing off against the other, to say this is good and all that stuff is bad, and to operate out of this. You go to your extreme with this, you end up with something like an Oklahoma City. And now what do we do? Now we take these, use some four-letter word here for these guys, you know, and we take these guys and then we're going to do what? How do we deal with it? The enlightened way of dealing with this is to get back to wholeness, to reality, to realize that this is human delusion. This goes on in the world. You don't then continue to act in a divisive way. I mean, like, for example, now we take Timothy McVeigh and we put him to death. Okay, well, I can understand why people want him put to death. You know, he did apparently he did this, and it's a horrible thing to do. But we put him to death. We do the very same thing that he did. And then who's going to put them to death? The state, we say? What's the state? The state is just a group of people. What gives any group of people? Well, there is a group of people. Do we have a right to determine who lives and who dies? Or do we say that, no, none of us do? Because killing is wrong. That's why we got to do something about Tim McVeigh. But what should we do about Tim McVeigh? And why did Tim McVeigh become Tim McVeigh? A whole history there. Many things have happened in his life. Parents separated, you know, and all kinds of things have happened there. And also, we put Tim McVeigh to death. And now there's all these militia groups all around. And Tim McVeigh becomes a cause for them to have another Oklahoma City. It goes on and on and on and on. In Buddhism, we don't call that bad or evil as such, because that doesn't get to the heart of it. to say bad, that's too easy. He just throws it, that's bad, you're bad. You did this, you're bad. No. The point is human delusion, human confusion, human ignorance. This is the problem. Tim McVeigh was caught up in it. If he weren't caught up in it, he would have never done what he did. And now we're going to put him to death. We're caught up in it as a society. We're caught up in human delusion and confusion. And while we don't say this is bad or evil, it is what it is. And it's delusion and it's confusion. And it goes on. If we don't put an end to it, and how do we put an end to it? We put an end to it by learning to observe this moment, seeing what's going on, seeing what goes on in our own mind, to notice how hatred rises in our mind, how we separate one thing from another in our mind, and we say this is good, this is bad, whatever. This is the problem. This labeling of things as good and bad in the first place. This intensifies and perpetuates the problem of human delusion. The only way out of this is to stop that. Just stop putting on the labels. And what else can we do? Now let's start to pay attention to human life as we live it from moment to moment. So don't think for a moment that because Zen won't throw the label bad on something, that it's saying, oh, this is okay. You know, some people have that idea about Zen. Zen says, well, anything goes. No, I guarantee it. Oklahoma City does not go. Because Oklahoma City is human delusion, an extreme example of it, and that doesn't go. Zen is about learning to become awake and to see what's going on in each moment. And the first thing you do is you learn to do this in your own mind. And you just see how you're acting out of division and hatred and confusion in your own mind. You learn to see how you're doing that, and when you do, you'll stop. And that's the only way you're going to stop. That's the only way you're going to stop as an individual. Me as an individual, each one of us as individuals, and it's the only way that society as a whole could stop is through us as individuals learning to observe our own mind. This is the only way something like that could ever come to a stop. But in Zen, we don't promise that it will come to a stop because we live in the human world, and the human world is muddy water. That's just how it is. But it doesn't mean that we don't stop to, well, something I wanted to get there. I wanted to end on it tonight, but I don't think I'm going to get there. The Bodhisattva's Four Vows. Let me just jump ahead to that point because it kind of ties into this. At the bottom of page 45, here they're called Buddhist vows. A Bodhisattva is a person who is attempting, striving to become awake, who's vowed to walk this path of awakening. The first vow is, although sentient beings are innumerable, we vow to save them. Although our evil desires are limitless, we vow to rid them. Although the teaching is limitless, we vow to learn it all. Although Buddhism is unattainable, we vow to attain it. Now, when I was in Japan, well, let's put it this way. When they were first translating this, getting these vows into English, they had a real problem because in Japanese, these vows do not state I or we. They're not stated in that way. And actually in Japanese, they hardly ever use the term I. The whole time I was there, I the only time I ever heard it was one time when a monk was there. I was in a monastery with another fellow who was from England, spoke English, didn't speak Japanese. And he was arguing with a monk about who was going to sweep the hall, you know. And they both had the broom. And they were finally the monk, he said, "Watashi, watashi," and it means me, you know. And he started pointing to his nose like this. The only time I ever heard anybody use the word I or me. Here we point like this, you know. He was going like, "What the?" But anyway, they don't use the word I. But when they try to translate it into English, they had difficulty. But I think we can get rid of it if we just. This is how I've laid out these vows. The first vow is just simply to save all sentient beings, though they are innumerable, to end all desiring, though desires are endless, to learn the Dharma, though it is boundless. Dharma is the teaching of the Buddha or of the awakened, and to attain awakening, though it is unattainable. That last one, to attain awakening, though it is unattainable. A couple weeks ago at the precept ceremony that we did, if you remember in the Heart Sutra that we chanted, we talked about, no attainment. And then a little later on, we're talking about the Buddhas having attained complete, unexcelled, perfect enlightenment. You know, so after saying no attainment, and so what do you mean no attainment? Well, the perfection of attainment is no attainment, and that's what it's talking about here. So to attain complete, perfect, unexcelled enlightenment, this is no attainment. And so that to attain awakening, to really attain awakening, this is not attainment. This is not getting hold of something as we normally do. What we've attained is a freedom from this grasping, greedy mind that we have. This is true attainment. But you realize at this moment there's nothing here that's been attained, and yet we're free. You see, and this is what we have to come to. This is the same way that we're going to cure this Oklahoma City problem. If we don't want to perpetuate the problem and the difficulty and the ignorance and the stupidity that we always engage in as human beings, we have to see through this. As I was saying, we live in this muddy water. This is just how it is. The point here is that he says that to save all sentient beings, though they're innumerable, we can't save all sentient beings. To end all desiring, though desires are endless. But we think, we approach something like we have to bring it to an end, we have to stop it, we have to stop desiring, we have to stop this grasping, this greedy mind, we have to learn the complete teaching of the Buddha, even though it cannot be attained or learned or grasped. How do we do this? We have the idea that we approach something only because it can be done. By golly, I'm going to succeed. I'm going to get it. And if I can't get it, if I can't succeed in doing it, then there's no point in doing it. And we dismiss it. And when we dismiss it, we don't realize that we've just ignored, we pushed away the very means by which we can acquire a life of sanity and a life of peace and harmony. So this is the example we saw in Oklahoma City and the way we finally reacted to it. We did the exact wrong thing. We continue to perpetuate the problem. We really have to stop it. And how do we stop it? We stop it by learning to see in this moment. We live in this muddy water, and yet what can we do? What can we do? We can purify ourselves. We can purify our own mind. We can help other people to gain this kind of sanity. And then perhaps we can have some effect on society at large. This is the only cure that we have. And the fact that it is impossible, that we can't do this, that we live in this muddy water, and that we can't purify the water, but we can purify ourselves, with our ordinary, greedy, grasping mind, we say, well, so what? This is hopeless. What's the point? Well, the point is that in learning to see in this way, we find freedom in it, we find sanity in it, and this is the only way that you will have acquire the ability to affect the sanity of others. And I'm not convinced that it is entirely impossible, but we go ahead and do it every anyway. It's just like, I think I've told the story of the little bird. In Zen, we have the story of the little bird there's this forest fire, you know, raging, and this little bird flies 20 miles and scoops up some water in her beak, you know, a little drop of water. Then she flies 20 miles, drops it on the forest fire, flies back to the lake, gets another drop. And, of course, all the other animals are sitting around saying, that's ridiculous. You're not going to put out that fire, you know. Why do it? See, so we think like that. We think, if you can't bring this about, if you can't change the world, if you can't make the world pure, then why try? Let me kind of give up. And then what? Well, we might as well entertain ourselves, you know, hang out at the bar, watch TV, I don't know, go to the lake, you know, do something, you know, but just forget it. And the world goes on in this way. But why can't you? Why can't you scoop up that water, fly to the lake, and pretty soon maybe somebody else notices what you're doing, and then you go ahead and do that. Thich Nhat Hanh tells a story of the fellow who, and the boat people were out on the lake, and the lake started to, you know, go wild, and people were crammed in a little tiny boat, and they were about ready to panic. He told a story of one fellow who was able to keep his head, keep sane, and he had a profound effect on everybody else in the boat. And they all calmed down. They all kept their heads. And they attended to what they needed to attend to until they rode out the storm. And they all survived to tell the story. So for each one of us, if you can get sane, if you can come into this moment, be awake in this moment, stop putting it on others or whatever, then maybe you can help them. Maybe we can help Tim McVeigh. You know, and I'll tell you too, for the people who suffered, the families and everyone who suffered from that bombing, the only way that they're going to find healing in their own heart and forgiveness in their own heart and to get past this and to go on with their lives is to do just this. It's not going to come through vengeance or perpetuating the problem. No, we've got to bring it to an end. This is sanity. And never mind the fact that we can't actually purify the world. We can purify our own mind. And when we do that, we're cured. And we can help others. Now we can help others. Now we can do something for the world. Before that, you cannot. And that's what we were talking about just a moment ago here, that if you're insane, you can't do anything for others. The first thing you have to do is make yourself sane. And now you can begin to act out of that. Niles, you had a question?
Oh, just one little comment. I was thinking of one example of Ellen Bird, for example, in Rosa Parks. She wouldn't stand up and give her seat.
Mm-hmm.
What happened next?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sure. Mm-hmm. Kind of example of the little bird, huh? And other people took notice. Yeah. Okay, well, Merrill of Zen. Where were we at this? Okay, at the bottom of page, I guess it's 38, he said, those who can sit perfectly physically usually take more time to obtain the true way of Zen, the actual feeling of Zen, the marrow of Zen. But those who find great difficulties in practicing Zen will find more meaning in it. A little further down, he says, when we talk about Zen, we cannot say he is good, he is bad. That's kind of what you were talking about before. Further down, he says, even though you cannot take the right posture, when you arouse the real way-seeking mind, you can practice Zen in its true sense. It is easier for those who have difficulties in sitting to arouse their true way-seeking mind than for those who can sit easily. So the point here then is that in Zen and in this practice is don't get bogged down in your mind. Don't get bogged down into thinking that you can't do this or that you know that this Zazen stuff is too hard. Forget about if you can't get into the full lotus position or whatever, then you know, sit your meditation in a chair. It doesn't matter. The fact of the matter is that you can learn to attend to your life as you're living it from moment to moment. And there's no need to get down in despair. There's also no need to get down in despair over, say, Oklahoma City or Tim McVeigh. This is the world that we live in. We might as well just face up to it now, and now let's go on. This is nothing new. We understand this. This is as old as humankind. You know, these kinds of difficulty. But what can we do? Don't despair. In each moment you have another chance. Just come back to this moment and see what's going on. This is all we have to do. So we don't need to despair. Then a little further down, again on page 39, he said that according to Dogen, and by the way, I should say that Dogen Zenji, for those of you who might not know, is a great Japanese Zen master of the 13th century, and he talks about him quite a bit. He's kind of the founder of the Soto school of Zen, which is what Suzuki Roshi is and what my training is in Japan, and a great Zen master. He's done a lot of writing, and we probably can study some of his stuff later on. But here he says, according to Dogen, he talks about this one continuous mistake. He says, one continuous mistake can also be Zen. A Zen master's life could be said to be so many years of one continuous mistake. So he said, this is so many years of single-minded effort. One continuous mistake. This is Zen master's life. This might sound kind of discouraging, perhaps. You want to learn to make one continuous mistake. But you do make. You ever notice? It's just that the Zen master is aware of one continuous mistake. But this is really wonderful if we truly understand this, because now this is where we can apply effort. If your life was perfect, if you were living your life flawlessly and perfectly, no mistakes. Well, first of all, have you ever met anybody like this? Well, that's not even human life. We're in this muddy water. We're constantly bumping up these mud molecules, you know. You can't live your life perfectly, no matter what. Even though you work very hard as a Zen master for many years, you study this way of life, etc., but it is nothing but one continuous mistake. You can't bring it to perfection, but this gives you something to work with. This is where we make our effort. We make the effort in the realm of the imperfect. So he said this means so many years of single-minded effort in the realm of imperfection. It's the same for your life. You don't have to be a Zen master. It doesn't change anything. But if you don't understand this point, then you're always going to be operating and trying to perfect this, trying to make this the best, even though it might be the worst or the worst or whatever. So this is a very important point. In the next chapter, he said, we say a good father is not a good father. You know, because the fellow who thinks that he's a good father, well, he might not be a good father. One who thinks he's a good husband is not a good husband. Yeah, if you think you're a good husband, how can you be a good husband? Or if you think you're a good wife, how can you be a good wife? What is a good wife or a good husband or a good father? In the realm of imperfection, in the realm of one continuous mistake. What is a good child? Have you been a good child? Have you been the perfect child for your parents? Or have you caused your parents difficulty in life, you know? And if, for those of you who are parents, if we ever sit back and think that we've attained some kind of perfection, as a human being living in this realm of muddy water, we're very deluded about ourselves. And we also can become very complacent at that point, very proud. But this is not really, this is not enlightenment. And even if you become the enlightened person, of course you can't be an enlightened person, because you can immediately fall back into the realm of delusion again, where there's one continuous mistake where you can't be the perfect husband, the perfect wife, whatever. This is the realm, and yet we continue to work on being present in this moment. Like my teacher used to put it, he said there's no such thing as a good driver. Because we've talked about this before, some of you have heard this. Because the life that we're living is something ongoing from moment to moment. Everything is constantly changing. You cannot say you're a good driver. You cannot say you're a good husband, a good child, a good wife, a good Zen master. You cannot say this. Because from moment to moment, everything is constantly changing. And as you're driving down the street telling everybody what a good driver you are, you know, then you run into a tree, you see. So where's good driver? It's just in, you mean now or now? When? When are you a good driver? You know, when are you a good husband? You mean now or how about now? You know, this is the reality that we live in. So to even think, then, as he's saying here, that you're a good father, well, this is not a good father. One who thinks that he is the worst husband may be a good one. You know, probably stand a better chance anyway. You know, but also when we realize now that you're in a relationship with someone else, father, son, mother, daughter, you know, husband, wife, whatever, that if you realize that you're not this perfect person in this relationship, then also maybe you can develop kind of a tolerance, you know, and accept the fact that, well, whatever relationship you're in with others, they're not the perfect whatever either, you see. Do you expect them to be? Of course not. But actually you do. You expect them all to be a Buddha and everyone else to be perfect. But this is kind of our delusion. You should turn that one around. This is what we do in Zen. We try to turn that one around and realize that, well, what about you now? Everybody's looking at you. Everybody wants you to be a Buddha. Everybody wants you to be perfect. When they're driving behind you in traffic, they want you to be perfect. If they're speeding, they want you to get out of their way and let them go through. And this is what people want. This is what they expect of you. And so why don't you? Why don't you just practice this one continuous mistake? You're constantly, I annoyed that driver on the freeway inadvertently. The realm of one continuous mistake. But now, just make your effort to be here, to be the best driver, to be the best husband, to be the best wife. And in the effort of doing this, you're not judging the other. You can kind of tone it back a little bit to the extent that you're taking on the responsibility. Okay, they want me to be a Buddha here. They want me to be this perfect being. You make that effort. You're going to fail, of course. We all do. But make that your focus, and you'll start to notice that pretty soon, you know, you can tolerate other people. They don't make you so angry. They don't hurt your feelings as much. You're less likely to take offense, etc. And life is a lot easier. This is going back to the idea about the boss being awake. When you're awake, the whole world is awake. This is what's happening, you see. Have you really changed anybody out there? Well, maybe not so much, no. But it's that interaction between you and everyone else. Laura?
What about when you're in a situation where you're asked to judge other people? Like in your job, you're in a business, and you really don't want to do that. You don't want to have to make those kind of decisions. As far as your job, and you have to run a report.
Mm-hmm.
Why this person should get the job and this person shouldn't.
Yeah, well, if you have to do that, this is the world we live in. But, I mean, you're in a situation, you have to evaluate people, you're interviewing people for a job or whatever, and obviously, five people come in, you can only pick one. You have to say no to the other four. This is the situation you're in. But, again, the focus is with you. You look at them, but as much as possible, if you notice that, well, I like the way that person was dressed, or, you know, if you're starting to let your own personal stuff get in there, you just watch that. This is Zen practice. It's just to watch what you're doing and see if you can step away from that now, and then just go ahead and do your job. Just do what you have to do. If you have to pick one person, then pick one person. If you can pick one person now with a mind that is centered, calm, and even, then you can go ahead and you can make that decision and just go ahead and do it. Free of guilt, any kind of, no one can reproach you afterward for that. Well, maybe someone will, but when you're secure now in your own mind, you see. So in the end, this is the easiest path to take, you know.
As you're talking, I'm thinking that part of my problem with being in those kind of situations is that I imagine how I feel being in the other situation.
Mm-hmm.
So I know how secure I am about being judged by other people.
Sure. Yeah.
Like, you know, next time around, I'll be in the other situation.
Yeah. And another thing in terms of judgment, that to the extent that you keep your mind balanced, of course, the other people, they won't know this, but they have no reason to fear you now. You know, as a judge, they will, because they're attached to your decision, but they have no reason to fear you, because you will be fair. And you'll also will be able, to the extent you can make your mind balanced, to that extent you'll be able to see each individual person more clearly. So every way you look at it, you just really simplify the problem. But after the decision, if you find yourself having all kinds of second thoughts and things, well, the only reason that would come about is because you weren't really fully collected at the moment you made that decision. So that's the point here in Zen. Always come back to this moment and observe your own mind, and now do what you have to do. This is your job, to hire, fire, whatever. You were hired to do that. Just do your job. But the point, no matter what your job is, no matter what the task is, driving a car, doing dishes, or hiring and firing, bring yourself into this moment, and now you can act. And that's the whole point behind this. That is getting to the marrow of Zen. So even though you are the worst horse, you will get to the marrow of Zen. On page 40, further down, he said, no other activity will appease your suffering. No other activity than what we're just discussing here, learning to get into this moment and see your own mind. This is to get into the practice of Zen, to do Zazen. It has nothing to do with sitting down. Sitting zazen is not necessarily sitting zazen. To do zazen is simply to be in this moment, in other words, to come into this moment of meditation, just simply to be here. No matter what position you're in, you can do this. In this activity, just coming into this moment, he said, this will appease your suffering. In other restless positions, you have no power to accept your difficulties. None whatsoever. But in zazen, and he says here, the zazen posture, which you have acquired by long, hard practice, your mind and body have a great power to accept things as they are, whether they are agreeable or disagreeable. And that would apply even to the case of when you got to pick one person for this job out of five. It's a disagreeable situation. You don't like it. But if that's the situation you're in, you can do this. And this is freedom. This is what we're talking about. This is complete freedom of mind. This is what Zen ultimately offers to us. But it's through doing this work of learning to come into this moment, seeing this moment for what it is. At the bottom of the page there, he said, when you are sitting in the middle of your own problem, which is more real to you, your problem or yourself? Interesting question, isn't it? The awareness that you are here right now is the ultimate fact. This is the point you will realize by zazen practice. The awareness that you are here right now, in other words, the awareness that you have is not that you are here right now, it's just simply this, to come into this moment. This is the ultimate fact, that there's this going on. What is it? Cannot say what it is. But one thing is absolutely sure, is that there is this moment. Something is going on. And this is the ultimate fact of our life, is that you are here. Okay, when you're sitting in the middle of your own problem, which is more real, you or your problem? If you're truly sitting in the middle of your problem, and you're truly here, you don't have a problem. It's as simple as that. So what's most real? You? A problem? No, it's just right here. Just to be here. He calls it you. But this you is kind of, he also, at other points he calls it your big self. This isn't you. This isn't your ego. If you are truly here, you're not here as yourself. Or to truly be here is not to be here. It's kind of like with attainment. Well, up to that, no point in starting another one. Any questions? Yeah, Chuck.
I'm just a little confused on the intent to be a good father.
Yeah. Did I say that? Sure. What is the intent of being a good father?
I don't know.
It's to be awake.
Right.
If you want
okay,
to be...
Okay.
Because that's the focus, that's the point. If your intention is to be awake
right.
in this moment, but if your intent is to be a good father, no, you have this idea. You kill that Buddha. See? And, yeah. So, but this is always the point, and we shouldn't lose sight of this. It's always the intent is to be awake. This is single-pointed. We'll talk about this at some point here. This is the single-pointed way to come back to awakening. And if you do this, you come into this moment, there's no problem here. You don't have a problem if you're in this moment. I don't care what your situation is. You do not have a problem if you can truly come into this moment. And this is the end of dukkha, the end of suffering. But we're always setting it out over there, and now we have a problem. In effect, then, it's just to become, you marry your problem, you become one with the problem, and it's not a problem. I saw a couple of hands were actually out of time, but go ahead, Mary.
I'll keep here. I'm just thinking, about being a good cook, that you're never a good cook because there's always the next meal.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, and you might have just dropped all the salt in the soup just now. And that's true. Phil, you had something?
Well, I don't know, I'm just thinking, when my boss is kicking my ass, I've got a problem. And also, it's my person. And I'm thinking dualistically, but it's mm-hmm. still hard to be not
yeah.
aware of the situation. But that doesn't help me much, at least.
Well, yeah, but be aware of the situation, you know, and your boss is down on you right now. And there you are. Just come into that moment and you can deal with it. If you don't, no, you're going to have a fight with your boss, or you're going to go home and yell at your wife or whatever. But you come into this moment, and that's the only place you're ever going to deal with it, is right here when it's happening. We spend so much of our time living in our conceptualizing mind. We project it out there. Oh, him. He's doing this to me. And so now you're going to work on him, or you know, it'll just spin on in all kinds of ways. But what about you? Come into this moment. And I'll see if you can deal with this moment. It involves your boss right now who's angry. Okay. But you can't escape that moment. The fact is, the boss just isn't going to disappear because you don't want this situation. You know, the best way to deal with it is just to, you know, swallow it and stand up right there and deal with it. But in order to do that, you got to come into that moment, and then you can handle it. It's not a problem. The only time we have a problem is when it's projected outside of ourselves in our mind. Now we go running off wildly, screaming, kicking, trying to change that out there. So this is the simple lesson. You know, it's difficult to do. And what's really difficult, what Suzuki was saying earlier about keeping our practice pure, is to realize what we have to do. Come back to this moment right here, right now. This is what we shouldn't lose sight of. We get elated, we get excited, we get angry. And we lose track of this moment. Now we're lost. Now we live in suffering. Okay, well, next week we'll pick it up. I think I wanted to go on to part two, but I'm not sure. I still had some things I wanted to cover, but we'll take it up next week. Talk to you then.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.